Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating as always. Coming up in this week's program, we're going to be talking about space and specifically bacteria and viruses in space. I'm surprised this hasn't been a movie. Maybe it has that I haven't seen yet. But when we think of space, we often think of a very clean place. But of course, there are lots of bacteria floating around. And it turns out they mutate in space. Is that a bad thing? Find out in a few minutes' time. But if you'd like to get in touch with us on the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end of the podcast. We kick off, though, looking back at some of the week's breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from the RCSI, the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, Dr. Annie Curtis. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Annie, has to do with bowel cancer and is actually a good story for once.
It certainly is, Jonathan. So this was a study that was published from the University of Oxford, and it was published in a really nice journal called Nature Communications. And basically the main finding from this was that having a large glass of milk every day may cut the risk of bowel cancer by nearly a fifth. And the reason for that is due to the calcium in the milk. So bowel cancer is a really devastating disease. You know, up until maybe a couple of decades ago, it was really mainly only people over 50 who were being diagnosed with bowel cancer. But people are being diagnosed with bowel cancer younger and younger, especially in high income countries. So it's really something that we have to, you know, keep an eye on and be concerned about and understand what's going on. And there's been some studies showing the effects of different food groups on bowel cancer, but this was definitely the most kind of robust study that's been conducted. So there was over 500,000 postmenopausal women tracked for 17 years, and they looked at 97 food groups. And from that, they could see that there was this positive correlation between calcium and reduced risk of bowel cancer. But then, unfortunately, it did pull out that alcohol and red or processed meat were really quite bad in terms of preventing bowel cancer. So a large glass of red wine is linked with a 15% increase in this disease, red and processed meat.
Whoa, not one glass of wine. One glass of wine per week, is it, or per month?
No, per day. Yes.
Per day, okay. What if I were to have all of my glasses of red wine on a single day? Does that count as one day or does that count as 5 days?
I think that counts as five. Well, I suppose it all depends, yeah, because it's all been flushed through at the one time. And the reason, and I was, you know, as I was reading this, I was thinking of, you know, dry January and all of that. And, you know, maybe we should be extending dry January to the rest of the year. And the reason why alcohol has been associated with this increase in bowel cancer is because it produces this compound called acetaldehyde, and that's been found to be very mutagenic in high concentrations. It disrupts DNA repair. So, you know, that's sort of the mechanism behind it. So, but certainly calcium, very protective. Let's all get our glass of milk or yogurts in during the day.
I don't know if you're familiar with the webpage, the things that Daily Mail says gives you cancer, but it is an extraordinary list of items that goes on forever. And it's everything from windows to staying in and staying out at the same time. So, you know, the things that link to cancer are as long as the night is. But
I would say this is a robust study in terms of the number of people and the follow-up, you know, over 17 years.
You're talking a lot of people. Yeah. So, I mean, we knew about alcohol and red meat. It's great to hear that milk is preventative because my kids drink it every day as I do. So that's great, but unsurprising, I suppose.
And it doesn't have to be dairy. It's, you know, any sources of calcium seems to be protective.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Shane, our second story has to do with Pluto and a new theory about how it came to get its moons.
Yeah, its little moon is called Charon, spelt with a C, and they orbit each other, which is partly the reason that Pluto is no longer considered a planet. So it meets two of the three criteria. It goes around the sun, it's spherical, big enough to be spherical, but it doesn't have what they call orbital dominance. So it's not a gravitational bully in its part of space, and isn't Charon go around one another. And Charon, its moon, its diameter is around half that of Pluto. So it's sizable, compared to the size of Pluto itself. And just recently, there was a paper published in Nature Geoscience that published on a modeling technique. So modeling is something that scientists do with computers to try and sort of predict the experimental outcomes, or to turn the clock backwards in situations like this, where we could never do an experiment to collide two objects together in space, at least not yet anyway. And they describe a so-called kiss and capture event, which sounds like a horrible thing altogether. But what happens here is basically they reckon that an object in space in this so-called Kuiper belt would have collided with Pluto, the early planet of Pluto, and it would have formed a kind of a joined up two objects stuck together, almost like a snowman with a big blob and a small blob stuck to it. And they went around one another, and they were continuing to spin as they were joined together in this kind of weird blob. And through centripetal forces, these are the forces that pull things apart when they're spinning, and also basic things like, I guess, like Newton's third law, reaction forces, the two bodies separated and have been orbiting one another since then. Now, the reason that the study suggests this is, I couldn't believe they hadn't done this before. Their previous study, which we actually spoke about on the show back in 2015, it assumed that the two colliding bodies were a fluid. Now, anyone that knows anything about rocky planets would know they are not fluidic. So this new a version of the model basically was sophisticated enough to know that the two objects were made out of rock. And so when they collided with one another, they didn't behave as if there were two gases or two liquids colliding. And so the behavior is particularly different.
That is kind of mad. They didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool, though. It's quite romantic to have this planet out there, or like dwarf planet or whatever, that is spinning around. Are those sort of twin bodies very common in space?
Yeah. You mean spinning around one another? Yes, they are. Indeed, like it's also not uncommon for moons to have formed because big objects whacked into their associated planets, like our own moon, which is relatively large compared to our size, the size of Earth. It's thought that it formed in a massive collision, and we've spoken about that many times on the show. And we kind of do orbit one another, but we do on Earth exert orbital dominance. Listeners will be glad to hear.
Sounds very rude indeed. Our third story has to do with a very unusual place in the world, Chernobyl, and the dogs that reside there, Annie.
Yes, Jonathan. So the title of this article was Chernobyl's Dog's Genetic Differences, Not Due to Mutation. Okay, what is all this about? So basically, over in Chernobyl, they have these two separate dog populations that are separated by approximately 15 kilometers, and they're genetically distinct. One population resides in Chernobyl City in Ukraine, and then the other resides around the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. And we're all very familiar with the nuclear power plant disaster, which occurred in 1986. And there are very stark genetic differences between these two dog populations. And they wondered whether that was due to exposure to radiation, I suppose, from the disaster. Now, this team had already done some analysis on these two dog populations, and it actually showed that the dog population in the nuclear power plant, NPP, they were very distinct from the Chernobyl City dogs, but even other dogs, say like in Russia and in other places, right? So what they did was they went on a bit of a hunt to see if they could see differences at the chromosome level. So you're kind of going, you know, high up in terms of the genome, and then, you know, you go down further into the genome and you look at differences in single nucleotide bases, so the single bases. And in particular, they were looking for germline mutations, so changes in the DNA of reproductive cells. And obviously, they are the cells that are passed down from parent to offspring. But they didn't find anything, right? So they were kind of a bit perplexed at that. Because, you know, because even though this dog population is about 30 or more generations removed from the disaster, mutations would still be detectable if they conferred a survival advantage. So what they think might have happened is that there was a thing called selective pressure that went on. So when the disaster happened, it could have been that the dogs which survived long enough already had genetic traits that increased their ability to survive. So there was sort of this like, you know, almost selective pressure going on, you know, right from the time of the disaster. But you might ask, why is this important? And I think what's interesting about it is, well, first of all, we need to kind of understand these sort of radiological disasters like Chernobyl, but other disasters are going to happen in the future. And companion dogs, or companion animals like dogs, are really useful to study because, you know, they can offer us a window. You know, obviously they're in close proximity to humans and they can offer us a window of what might be going on with humans as well. So it is really important for us to understand these potential health risks to protect people. So yeah, a quirky study, but an interesting study nonetheless.
I suppose the environment has changed. If it's not the radiation that's caused these mutations, as you say, rather some sort of pressure or adaptation to the environment, no humans are really there. So there's no, you know, scraps to be eating. You know, there are very few humans in that area now. There are some workers, but it's not a lot of people. And maybe that lack of humans has led to a slight change in ecosystems. I know certainly the environment, if you go to Chernobyl, as I walked around it, there are plants sprouting up everywhere. It's like a kind of a wilderness again when it was a city. So it kind of makes sense that if the environment changes so dramatically in such a short space of time, that so might the genes of the animals living in it over 30 generations. Really interesting. Our final story, Shane, has to do with frogs.
Yeah, cricket frogs. But more importantly, Jonathan, it's finally answering the question you've always wanted to know, which is why you cannot walk on water.
Well, I knew that.
And the reason that you and indeed us mere mortals can't walk on water, Jonathan, is because the amount of gravitational force that we exert downward on the earth is greater than the surface tension of water. So in other words, we break.
Even I knew that, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Even you did that one, yeah. So that's why we can't walk on water.
I didn't need my omniscience for that one.
But some creatures can walk on water, and some of these creatures are the prey of the cricket frog. So it's advantageous for the little frog to be able to try and walk on water too. But it's too big, really, to try and use the same techniques that the pond skater and other insects would use. So the cricket frog is an American frog, North American frog, and it's about the size of an adult thumb. So it's big enough and it looks like it can walk on water. And recently in the Journal of Experimental Biology, some clever people looked a little bit closer at this so-called skittering effect, which is where the frog appears to just dance across the surface of fresh water in order to get where it needs to go.
Real Irish word.
Skittering. Exactly. So it turns out, though, that skittering is perhaps not an accurate reflection of what's really happening. They used high-speed photography, just like that famous video of the horse 100 plus years ago, 500 frames a second. And they saw that the entire body of the frog actually submerges into the water. There's more like a plop and a jump mechanism, or as they say in the paper, porpoising. Which is like where the porpoise jumps out of the water. It's more like a belly flop. And so all of this motion happens within about 1 second. It's really interesting to think the forces that the frog is exerting down into the water, and the water pushes the frog back up out of the water, and it can do these sequential jumps. In some of the videos, they'll do more than 10 in a go, and they're able to kind of get across most bodies of water. I love this story until I got to the final part, which is that they said that they're interested in the potential for biorobotics and potentially making amphibious drones. I just thought, why? Why does every piece of research have to end with some stupid military-like application like this, as opposed to just going, you know what, it's pretty cool that nature has evolved a little animal that can do this incredible thing. That's good enough. Leave it there. QED.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, look, I think sometimes you have to write those sentences at the end so you'll get the money for your research. So, you know, it doesn't seem like a very energy efficient way of moving across the surface of water to me. So, look, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and assume that they just said that so they were justifying their existence, which they shouldn't have to do. But sometimes that is the way of the world. Brilliant. Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Annie Curtis, thank you for all your skittering this afternoon. Now, one of the things they don't tell you often about space travel is that it can wreak havoc on your immune system. It's easy to become immunocompromised in space. But researchers right here in Ireland are working to stop chemicals, bacteria and fungi from attacking the bodies of astronauts. Dr. Lokesh Joshi is a Stokes Professor of Glycosciences at the Infectious Diseases section of the School of Biological and Chemical Sciences at the University of Galway. Good Lord, Lokesh, that's a long title. Welcome to the program, Lokesh. Great to have you on again. How are you?
Jonathan, thank you so much for the invitation. Happy to be here.
So tell me a little bit about this, because I didn't realize that space reduced our immunity. How does it do that?
Yeah, it's interesting, Jonathan. And I think we all grew up looking up in the sky and thinking, okay, it would be great to be an astronaut, if not a pilot. And space is the next frontier. At the same time, there's been research going on for the last, I would say, 40, 50 years to see that when we take the gravity away from our body or any organism's body, the physiology or the body's different chemical reactions are affected by the lack of gravity. So what happens is that when astronauts go into space, it affects their body a lot. And one of the things it does is that it kind of compromises the immune system. People don't understand how it is done at the molecular level, but they do know that astronauts are immunocompromised. Not only that, as we published before, that affects their bones, their muscles, their vision. So it's just that it's great to explore space. It's great to think about, having bases on Moon, going to Mars. But we still don't understand how that space travel will impact our own bodies.
I thought, now that I think about it, of course it can be, but I kind of thought that a space environment would be very sterile. I mean, it is in the movies, obviously, but of course, if you are bringing things into that environment and you have humans in that environment, you're going to have viruses, you're going to have bacteria. Is that right?
I think you're 100% right, Jonathan. Like, if you think about it, and again, the science is changing, we're learning a lot. So we have about 38 to 40 trillion cells in our own body, but we have almost equal number of microbes in and on our body. So we are never sterile. We have 40 trillion passengers with us. Wherever we go, they'll come with us. And not like 99% are the good guys, but there are some that are what we call opportunistic. As soon as we become immunocompromised, they take over or they try to cause infectious diseases. I think that's 1% of the one that NASA or European Space Agency would be concerned about. That when astronauts are immunocompromised, can that 1% cause infections, and also can it spread infections among the astronauts in the space shuttle?
These bacteria and viruses, have they been studied to understand how they change in space? Because presumably the human body changes, that must mean that viruses and bacteria are subject to change as well.
That's an amazing question, really. So the research actually, like anything else, when you start research, is never conclusive in some ways. So the answer is that some bacteria and viruses do become what we call more virulent, more aggressive, and some become less virulent and less aggressive. So it's not clear, and they don't know how microbes will react to the microgravity. And also they don't know how they'll react in longer term microgravity, how they'll mutate, how they'll become antibiotic resistant. So that whole area has not been studied so far. And that's why there's concern that if something becomes completely resistant to all the antibiotics, what will they do about it?
So, I mean, I know this isn't your area specifically, but do we know if the common cold or the flu viruses have been, stored in space and examined? Because if your immunotherapy goes down and some viruses could become more virulent, a seemingly innocuous virus or bacteria could end up being very dangerous.
I think you're absolutely right. All I can say right now, I think, is that we don't understand what we call the pathogen biology really well. They have seen that some pathogens stick to us more strongly and some do not. So it's very hard. And it's also very hard to do these experiments, Jonathan. So a lot of these things done on cell lines or on animals, but it's very hard to know precisely. And you don't want to expose astronauts intentionally with anything there.
What about your work then? Because you're working with the European Space Agency. This project that you're working on is funded by them. They have human missions coming up on the slate, not so far away.
Yeah. So it's an interesting one. When I was working in the US many years ago, I worked with Johnson Space Station looking at the protein production. This was many years ago. When I came to Ireland, I still maintained the interest in looking at the space biology, basically. And within that, our expertise is how do cells communicate with each other? How do they attach to each other? Or how do they send signals? And that is maintained by proteins and sugars on the cell surfaces. It's like the words we are using. If I have a lisp, if I have a slur, if I change language, then you start missing the messages. And that's what happens to cells when they go through diseases, through stress, and space is a stressful environment. So we approached European Space Agency, and that's part actually, this work is done by a University of Galway startup company called Aquila Bioscience, which has developed a technology in collaboration with the Defence Forces Ireland to protect the frontline responders from pathogen attack, let's put it that way. And the technology is really based on how nature does it all the time. You know, we are eating, drinking, breathing, we inhale, we're exposed, but we don't get sick every day. So how does nature do it and how it's been doing for millions of years? So we brought the same proposal to European Space Agency. And the reason, one reason was that right now what is being used is the same old harsh chemicals that we use in the kitchen or in the toilet.
Bleach, chlorine, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And you just can't keep using it in the space environment because they are oxidizing, you know, and they destroy the surfaces, they destroy the skin, they destroy also the mucosal things. So space agencies are looking for gentler ways that are biodegradable, that don't cause harm to their shuttles and the people there, and they're effective. So that's where we proposed our technology that, look, you know, we have a set of biological solution that is not harsh, it's not based on alcohol, and also it's not flammable. Like, you know, they are bringing flammable solutions on space shuttle, which doesn't make sense.
Yeah. If you're using rubbing alcohol as a cleaner, that can be problematic for sure. So you're using biomimicry to understand how plants and animals deal with pathogens. Can you tell me, drill into that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'll be happy to. So I guess, you know, it's one of those things that sometimes things are in front of your eyes, under your nose, but we don't see it, you know, because we think we have a solution. So all the current, what we call disinfectants, they've been around for over 100 years, you know, alcohol, bleach, as you mentioned, hydrogen peroxide, and yeah, yes, they work. But at the same time, if they work 99%, but the 1% they don't kill, they are the ones that become resistant, you know, and then the resistance grows, you know, because chemicals only work so much. And also chemicals are a bit like sledgehammer. It kills everything. It kills our cells. It kills our lung cells. You know, it has so many things we don't notice. So what we did as biologists is that, okay, let's just see what happens in nature. So, and the simplest example, Jonathan, would be that mothers feed their babies with milk. And milk has molecules that protect the children or small babies from gastroenteric pathogens. Or we produce mucus. You and I produce like 2 liters of mucus every day. You know, one role it has is that you know, seems like why? But the one reason it is that, you know, we are exposed to pathogens all the time. We produce tears, we produce urine. So all animals, you know, produce these molecules. And then nature has done that to trap the pathogens and remove them. So that's something that we studied, you know, over a number of years and through different, you know, funding from European agencies. So that's the proposal we have. And we are working with the European Space Agency to make something similar. So it's almost like a biomimicry-based membrane that the astronauts would have in their side pockets. And they can use it on their faces or any exposed surface and remove the pathogens without any chemical reaction.
You mean like a gel or something?
It will be a membrane.
What does that mean?
A membrane would be just a sheet. You know, it's like a thin wipe, you know, it's like a stretched cell membrane. It's like a cellophane or something like that.
Oh, right. And they just rub it on their hands.
Yes. Or their faces, you know, on their body. They can also use it to clean sensitive equipment that is actually corroded by repeated use of bleach or alcohol, etc.
And what's the mechanism? Because that seems like a less comprehensive way. Using sort of a dry sheet as opposed to something that is, you know, a gel that you can get into all of the nooks and crannies in your hands and so on. What's the mechanism of action there?
So that's a very good question. So it won't be a dry sheet, it will be a wet sheet. So that's one thing. And the mechanism would be that what we have created is what I would call, what we call almost like a biological Velcro. So it's a Velcro that is designed to capture bacteria, viruses, and fungi. and it leaves the skin and everything intact. So there's no chemical residue on your skin. It just falls or drops on your skin and just picks up all the bad guys and removes them. It's very clever.
Huh. And this biomimicry, where do you go about finding a mechanism like that? Like what sort of animals or plants or bacteria or viruses do that?
Well, in a way, we do that ourselves. As I mentioned, you know, we produce mucus. And when you eat, when you drink, when we inhale, our lungs produce mucus. And in fact, when we have cold, we produce more mucus. And the reason is our body is trying to expel the viruses or bacteria. You know, or when we eat food, they're being just bacteria, viruses, fungi. So the mucus wraps them up, you know, and a bit like Velcro-like molecules, and we expel it. So nature does it all the time. You know, if you look at animals, you know, they produce mucus. Some of them are covered in mucus. So they don't get sick every day. They don't use alcohol or bleach every day.
I've got a name for your product.
Go on, give it to me.
Mucus wipes.
Mucus wipes, yeah. That sounds good to me. People would love it, wouldn't they?
Do you think that would sell?
By the way, we do call it germ glue.
Germ glue.
So it's the glue for germs.
That's almost as bad as my one. Look, I think germ glue is very good. So when do you get to see, like, you're obviously, this is funded by the European Space Agency because and they're interested in this. The Artemis mission is not so far away where we're going to be sending people to the moon. They want to find a way of keeping their immune system uncompromised and reduce pathogens. When will you know whether or not your product will be ready for? Because you need to be ready and tested and verified all the way through before you do. You get to go on a, would you go on a different mission first to test it, or will your first mission actually be a human mission? And do you, how far off are you from that?
Again, very good question. You're putting me on the spot here. We are working with a colleague of ours. Her name is Dr. Lisa McNamee. She's the founder of Irish Medicine or Irish Space Medicine Organization. She's also a doctor with the Defence Forces who's now left Defence Forces, but you know, she's fantastic. So we're working with her as a clinical advisor to us. And our hope would be, Jonathan, is that we would be able to what we call a fly our technology next year, perhaps with a private mission. But at the same time, with the European Space Agency, we are working with them that in 18 months' time or so, we can fly our technology. And the reason there's this 18-month time is that we need to do a lot of proof of principle experiments and testing on ground, not only the lab, but also on human subjects or human volunteers to make sure that it's, you know, it works in the space environment.
Yeah, that sounds very exciting. And it's great to hear about Irish collaborations and potentially making European Space Agency missions. I do know, having visited the European Space Agency, how much work goes into getting a tiny innovation into space. So it is not an easy path you have chosen, but it's a really exciting one. Professor Lukesh Joshi from the University of Galway, thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
That's it from us on this week's podcast. Thanks to Marisa O'Sullivan, producer, Rory Gavin and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.